share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
At 12:08, this is WGN, and you are listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. We thank you for that. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is our producer. Lots of ground to cover today, and some of it includes where you might be going over the holiday weekend. We'll talk a little bit about gas prices. Patrick DeHaan will join us from the Petroleum Analysis Institute. GasBuddy.com is their website. Orion mentioned petroleum prices a moment ago. What's that mean at the pump, and where will you find that? It's kind of interesting to me because in the last couple of hours of our 9 to noon show, we were talking about people traveling across the country and how you're managing affairs. Would you rather drive than fly? And if you are driving, where will you find restrooms? What will their condition be? Will you have to wait in line? And will that keep some businesses from reopening because they want to have restrooms? But with social distancing and other procedures and protocols in place, maybe some of them cannot open up. It's a concern in Illinois when restaurants are actually thinking about the sort of soft opening that the governor is going to allow. We'll talk about gas prices, and that will be at around 12:35 here on WGN. Amy Guth will join us in the last segment around 12:45, and she's got a lot of business news. And we'll talk about one business in just a moment with Ian Schur from CNET, one business which is surprisingly doing well, or maybe not surprising. It seems like all medical information is suddenly business information. It's all economic information. In a way, those have always been tied, but never more so than now because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There's a website a couple of you have shared with me over the last few weeks called worldometers.info. If you just Google worldometers, W-O-R-L-D, World O Meters, you'll find a site that has a bunch of meters, which measures all kinds of things. It will tell you, you'll see a running total down to the person of the world's population, currently at 7.785 billion, for instance. You see the births and deaths as they are going up and down at any given moment. The wheels are spinning. 54 million births, 23 million deaths. So we are obviously having a lot more people than people are passing away even now. The tweets per day. When I looked at it earlier this morning, we were at 289 million tweets. And that was early this morning. Metrics on water and energy and health. And there's a COVID tab. And I guess that's the point of all of this. You'll see what the USA COVID-19 numbers are, and you can see them compared to the rest of the world as well. So if you're wondering how are we doing compared to Spain or Sweden or Australia or South Korea, those numbers are there. And when you want to know how Illinois is doing relative to other states, you will see that there as well. New York remains the state with the highest infection rate. For every million people, 1,478 are getting infected. 1,478 is their number. Illinois is 10th on that list at 357. So bad as it is here, it isn't nearly so bad as it remains in New York. The worst states, actually, I said infection rate, that was actually the death rate. I presume the numbers sort of follow, but the death rate in New York is 1,478 for every million. In Illinois, it's 357. The numbers are the worst in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Washington, D.C. Those are the big five. Louisiana is next. And again, Illinois is 10th on that list. States like Hawaii and Montana are suffering the fewest fatalities as a result of COVID-19. And that's just some of the things they look at Worldometers. It's 12:12. Okay, so Ian Schur says hello to us in just a couple of minutes. We'll talk about some of the story CNET is following. Ian Schur joins us. You hear his voice frequently. He's an editor at large at CNET. We've got a lot of ground to cover. Ian, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Pretty good. I was talking to somebody about how TVs are being used these days. You have a story about how Minecraft is doing pretty well, huh?
Yeah, it's actually rather amazing how much Minecraft has grown. So the company that owns it is Microsoft. You may have heard of them. And Minecraft is actually one of the best-selling games ever. It's topped now 200 million copies sold. To give you a comparison, Tetris, we all know that one, it has sold, by some estimates, 500 million copies. So that makes Minecraft number two, and it's really amazing to see how popular it is. For example, they say that there's 126 million people playing it each month, so more than half of the people who've bought it over the last 11 years that it's been a game are still playing, and they said that they, in the last month, they've tallied a 25% increase in new players and a 40% spike in the number of people playing together. And I think that speaks to how video games have gone from what we used to think of them as, which is nerds in the parents' basement, to a real social activity. And we've seen that games like Minecraft and Fortnite and all these games, you know, kids will get on them and play, but they'll also watch other people play. They'll get on the phone together and talk while they're playing. Fortnite has actually had music events in the game, so they have musicians come and perform. So it's really becoming its own social sphere and not just a thing where you blow up people and whatnot.
Is Minecraft? Have you played Minecraft?
I have, yes. I don't think you can get away from it these days. So I have played with it. I don't entirely wrap my head around it. Like, the idea of creating your own world has never been my personal thing. But the thing about Minecraft that really makes it popular is how open-ended it is, right? Literally, you're popped in the middle of a randomly generated world, and you can build whatever you want. You know, some people have built starships. Some people have built, like, physics experiments, and you can actually use it. There's a version of Minecraft now for education where they actually can allow you to create physics experiments and math experiments. So there's all sorts of stuff people can do in it, which I think is part of why it's so popular.
126 million people playing it each month, and that number higher maybe than normal because of COVID-19. People are sheltering in, and this is what they're doing, huh?
I would argue that it's probably, you know, if you look at those other numbers, right, the bumps they've seen in new players and the number of people playing together, I'd have to imagine some of that is related to COVID-19, but I also, you know, this was a trend that existed before that, and the idea of video games becoming this new social sphere, I mean, we all heard about Fortnite for a reason, and I think that's part of something to keep in mind is that, you know, a lot of people have Facebook and they have all these other things, but a lot of the younger people are not content to just go on Facebook and argue with their in-laws. They want to actually play video games and have fun while they're interacting with their friends online.
Somebody in my family has a birthday this week, and a trip to the Apple store would have been a logical birthday gift for that person. Happy birthday, Griff. But I can't go to the Apple store. The one right across the river from me is closed. Those are opening up soon?
Yeah, they're opening up in stages. So there are about 25 Apple stores in 7 states that have opened at this point, and the company has put out a letter, which we have a copy to link to on CNET, of course, where they discuss how they're going to open up the stores. So I don't know how often you've been in Apple stores, but one of the things I've always found really interesting about them is that they've become anchors to the malls that they're in. So oftentimes, they are the most well-trafficked stores wherever they are. And certainly when I've walked down a mall, even on a boring Sunday, the Apple stores are just filled with people, shoulder to shoulder. So Apple is going to change that a little bit. They said they're going to limit how many people can be in the store. Part of that will be based on local regulations, right? There are some places where they actually limit how many people per square foot can be in a store. But also they said that they want to make sure that they're able to keep social distancing. So they're going to have mandatory masks. If you don't have a mask, they're going to hand one to you. So think of it. It used to be, you know, shirts, shoes. Now it's mask as well. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Apple changes. You know, Apple, their stores have never really been about making a ton of money. Like, the company does that fine on its own. It's really been about marketing and branding, right? And you go to the Apple store and you have this this incredible experience that a lot of people talk about, and you feel better about Apple and you want to buy more of their stuff. And I think the real challenge for them will be continuing being able to do that with fewer people, right, and how people will feel comfortable about, you know, if this thing extends another year, as some estimates are going, you know, if I can't get into the Apple Store during the Christmas time to buy whatever thing I want to get, am I going to be frustrated with them? Am I going to be upset with their rules? Obviously, you know, it's going to be quite an interesting thing going forward, I think.
I'm surprised to hear you say that the retail points aren't major drivers of their revenue. The amount of money spent at those stores while I'm just standing there is staggering to me.
I'm not saying that they're not. I'm saying that for Apple internally, when they think about it, and when I was at the Wall Street Journal before I joined CNET, I wrote a big opus about how the Apple stores are run. And one of the things that constantly came back to me was that Apple internally would tell people that, you know, they would know, Apple knows how well things sell on their website, right? And they said, if you can beat the website, you're doing a good job. And I think what they're saying to these people, right, to their employees is, look, we're expecting you to give people a great experience and they'll buy stuff naturally. They're not on commission, so they actually push their employees to give people a better experience than just to make money. And I think that's very different from a lot of other stores, and part of why they've been able to cultivate that culture within their stores.
My experience has been that that is true. I never get upsold, and I think those people are so patient with me. And frankly, they just seem so smart and competent that I really appreciate the experience. Does that sound about right?
That's very much the way that they're designed, and part of why I get back to, you know, personally, I see it more as a marketing exercise than a store. Mm-hmm. And I know that's crazy when you think of how much money Apple makes. I mean, they actually make more money per square foot in those stores than Tiffany's does, which is just mind-blowing. But that's part of, I think, the interesting approach they have. You know, a lot of other stores, they try to pressure you. They try to upsell you or whatever. And at Apple, they're really just kind of sitting there being like, look, we're happy to teach you. We're happy to show you. But we don't care if you buy it. And that's a really unusual approach. I mean, obviously they want you to buy it, but they're not going to pressure you to.
There have been times where I wanted to ask one of them to come home with me and just, you know, because sometimes they'll say, well, it's real simple. What you need to do is just go home, transfer these files to some sort of additional hard drive, and then you'll be able to and suddenly it sounds so, you know, and you can sometimes just sense them getting a little impatient because, you know, they're not my mommy. They can't fix all of my problems, and I have a lot of problems when I'm in there. But again, I've
sat there in the Apple stores and heard a lot of impromptu sessions about life and, exactly, and all the troubles people are going through, in addition to fixing technology. So you're not alone, I think.
Why is CNET writing about Apple Glass? I thought that sort of came and went.
Well, at Google Glass is the thing that came and went. So, you know, at Google about, it's 8 to 9 years ago now, created these headsets that were called Google Glass, where they had a camera on your temple, right? They looked like a pair of glasses, but there was a camera there, and a little screen off to the right that would show you little bits of information, like an arrow if you're walking down the street to tell you where to go, or stuff like that. Well, it did not go well, partially because even in San Francisco, the tech hub, people were really uncomfortable with the idea of a camera staring you in the face all the time when you were talking to someone. So that kind of failed. But now Apple appears to be creating their version of it, and it's going to be, according to the rumors, called Apple Glass. We have all the rumors explained on CNET, of course. But I think what's really interesting about it is that Apple is, according to the rumors, not going to have a camera on it, because Apple, one of their big marketing things is they are very serious about your privacy, and of course they suggest that their competitors are not as good about it. And one of the things they're going to do is that they want it to look like normal glasses, just like the other people, and they're going to focus on giving you information that might be useful for you that you would not pull out your phone for. So again, if you're driving down the street, it might highlight where you need to go, where you need to turn, instead of looking at your phone. And I'll tell you that people get in a lot of accidents looking at your phone. There's, you know, a lot of the safe driving people say we really shouldn't even have our phones up on our dashboards. So Apple might be able to help with that. I don't know what they're going to do with it. It's really fascinating stuff that's coming out of not just Apple, but Facebook and Google and all these people. But there's a future happening soon where the phone starts getting into our glasses. And I really want to see what that turns into.
Are you Okay, good for you. I'm not sure I want that, and I and I suspect it doesn't matter what I want. The technology will go where the technology goes, but there'll be a market and appetite for that.
Well, there already is in the business world. So I'll give you an example. Microsoft has a product called HoloLens, H-O-L-O-L-E-N-S. I've actually gone and played with it at Microsoft's headquarters. We've got videos on CNET of that. And one of the things about it is that it's designed for the business world, and it does a lot of the same stuff. But I'll give you an example of where it's really been fascinating. So Chevron, the oil giant, often has experts they need to fly around the world to help out with anything happening on a rig. Well, it turns out that using these HoloLens devices and a camera, they're actually able to video chat wherever they need to go in the world, so it saves them like days of travel, and they're able to see exactly what the technician is looking at and actually highlight with a pen in the air what they need to work on. And it's actually saved Chevron millions of dollars. So there's actually very much of a market of it in the business world. The question will be whether you and I want it, and I don't know that yet, but the business world is really fascinated by this technology.
Ian Scher's on a phone line, editor-at-large at CNET. Talk to me about facial recognition firms. It came up on our show the other day, people wondering if they wear a face mask, will their phone recognize them, let alone other places where we have facial recognition. What's happening there?
Yeah, so right now they don't. There's an update that's been pushed to a lot of phones, including the iPhones, that if you have Face ID turned on and you try to use it with the mask on, it just shows you the PIN code entering stuff, and you do that instead. But one of the things that's going on is that researchers are saying that they are actually working on ways to identify you based on your cheek and your forehead and your eyes alone. And I think that's incredible when you consider that before that, they had to do, 100% of your face. Now we're talking about just, 50, 60% of your face or less, depending on how big the mask is. So I'm really curious about this, but there's also a lot of other debates that come out of this, right? Masks have been very popular with protesters in Hong Kong to keep the Chinese government from identifying and then persecuting them. So there's not just a thing about, our lives and how we in the West get to use our iPhones a little more easily or log into our computers or our banks and whatnot, wherever else Face ID is being used, but also what does it mean for surveillance in the future? And how comfortable are we with that? And there's a lot of debate about it right now. It seems pretty clear that this technology will happen, but the question is whether or not we're going to be comfortable with it and what it's going to mean going forward.
And that's just half of the stuff that we could have talked about today. It's all fascinating. Ian Scher is an editor-at-large over at CNET. Have a good holiday weekend, and let's visit next week, Ian.
Absolutely. Take care.
At 12:33, WGN. Hope you have a good Memorial Day weekend. Did it seem to sneak up on you, too? It's Thursday, I know. Tomorrow is Friday, and I guess the weekend for many folks will start sometime tomorrow and go through Tuesday. I'm taking tomorrow off, so it's going to feel like an especially long one for me, but also especially early. And maybe it's just because we're all in some sort of what-day-is-it fog with the COVID-19 crisis anyway. Patrick DeHaan is on a phone line, though, and if you are traveling, you might like some of the numbers that I think he's going to share with us. He's the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy.com. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
Am I right? Prices as low as we've seen them in a very long time, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly that. Now, prices have gone up, but this is the cheapest Memorial Day weekend that we've seen since 2003, the first time, at least nationally, that prices on Memorial Day weekend have averaged under $2. Now, yes, here in Chicagoland, of course, we're a little bit higher like we always are, but still, today, not a bad day. Still prices in the Chicagoland area almost a dollar a gallon less than 1 year ago.
$1.93 a gallon is the national average I'm reading on your site. And one other thing that jumped out at me is how high was it not that long ago? 2008, I guess on the heels of the financial crisis, the meltdown and all of that, gas was $3.92 a gallon. $3.92 a gallon, the national average on Memorial Day. Now it's $1.93, $2 exactly, almost exactly less. Amazing.
Pretty impressive where we've come from. And, unfortunately for many Americans, even amidst low prices, many of us are staying closer to home this year. A record amount of people will not be hitting the road this year. Though gasoline demand has gone up, I think as we progress through summer, July 4 will be a little bit more expensive than Memorial Day, and more people will likely be on the road. And the same would hold true then for Labor Day. So look for gas prices to trend up through the course of the summer, but pretty impressive, kicking off the summer at the lowest point since 2003.
All of this is a result of the coronavirus?
That's exactly it. Demand in March and April fell so significantly, and that drove prices down. Now we have seen some recovery, but gasoline demand nationwide still amounts to maybe 6.5 to 7 million barrels a day. That's almost 2 million barrels a day lower than where we were last year this time. So that sizable drop in demand is why gas prices remain far lower than that year-ago level.
And just 1 year ago, it was $2.83, so just shy of a dollar a gallon more expensive at $1.93 this Memorial Day. Ain't that the way? I mean, so now you can really afford to drive, but there's nothing to do when you get there. You can't even hardly pee along the way.
Yeah, that's right. Even if you do want to get out of town, the questions this year are, you know, not where are we going to visit or, you know, what theme parks are we going to go to, but it's, are they open? Are the restaurants open? Bars open? Are there things to do?
Well, there is a little more, you know, urgency to that in even in Chicago and in Illinois, and certainly elsewhere the country is starting to ease up. So I suspect, I mean, it does sound logical that by the 4th of July we'll even be more opened up, and, you know, maybe by Labor Day it'll be more expensive to travel and businesses will be flourishing more.
Yeah, let's hope our breath of that happens, and that's exactly why over the course of the summer we expect prices to go up, which is completely the opposite of what we normally see. Gas prices for the summer are usually highest during Memorial Day. We've usually just finished the transition to summer gasoline, and that leads prices up higher at the beginning of the summer, and then things trail off. This year, our low point is probably Memorial Day, and July 4 is going to be more expensive. And then Labor Day will be a little bit more expensive than July 4 because of the recovery that we're, at this point at least, anticipating.
I guess this is bad for everybody, obviously, and petroleum companies too. I suppose it is good for people, though, who budgeted for certain amounts of gas that they thought they were going to use. If I'm driving groceries around the country, there's still a market for that, and it's costing me less. Can you just talk about people who might be the beneficiaries of these low prices right now?
Well, you know, a lot of that is the American motoring public. Of course, a lot of us aren't necessarily driving as far, but some of the other end users that are beneficiaries of the lower energy prices, of course, airlines, but nobody really wants to get on a plane. You know, you talk about logistics companies, companies like Amazon, UPS, FedEx, that are large end users of petroleum. And keep in mind, those companies are delivering a lot more goods right now as we order online, and prices for them are much lower as well. So aside from you and I saving a couple bucks on a fill-up, some of those largest end users are the largest beneficiaries.
Our Orianne Samuelson was talking last couple of weeks about what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Russia. Does the United States control the petroleum prices to some degree? How much can the administration do, or are we victim of international petroleum politics here?
Well, you know, a lot of what the U.S. is that Russia and Saudi Arabia, like most oil-producing countries in OPEC, the amount of oil they're producing is a state decision. Saudi Arabia decides how much oil to produce. In the U.S., obviously, you know, we have different laws here. That would be considered collusion. But so many independent oil companies are producing that there's no body in the U.S. that's governing production. So the difference here is that the U.S. is more susceptible to the price of oil going low. If oil prices are low, which they are now, production drops. Whereas if prices are higher, if they do recover, oil production will likely increase just because oil companies are incentivized more to drill with higher prices than they are low prices. And of course, losses like oil prices trading in negative territory in the last few weeks, well, that's not incentivizing many oil companies to produce. So for now, U.S. oil production has been in decline.
Yeah, that's been a problem, hasn't it? Been literally where to put the product. I mean, some of it was sitting in tankers, sitting in bays. There has been a problem literally finding a place to put the stuff. Am I right about that?
Yeah, for a very brief period of time when Americans were not driving at all, back in early April, the numbers were very bleak for gasoline demand. The concern was that we were running out of space. Refineries were not buying oil to process because nobody was using those products. And so very quickly, the concern was storage, but that abruptly changed when we started to see a resurgence in gasoline demand that now is up for its fifth or sixth straight week as Americans get back in their cars. In fact, you could say 1.5 to 2 million barrels of gasoline has already returned, demand, I should say, of additional 1.5 to 2 million barrels has already returned, and that's 10 to 20%. So we've already seen a pretty good recovery in gasoline demand, which has been kind of a surprise.
One last thing. Patrick DeHaan's on the line, head of petroleum analysis, gasbuddy.com. The national average for this Memorial Day weekend, $1.93 a gallon, as you said, higher in the Chicago area, because it always is. Are there places, if I went north, south, east, west, that the prices would fluctuate much? Is there a good direction to go, or is it kind of uniform across the country?
Well, you know, it really does depend on where you're going. And, of course, just about any one of our neighbors, prices tend to be lower. And that's because Illinois, of course, last July raised state gasoline taxes. So if you're heading north, you'll find cheaper prices in Wisconsin. Northwest Indiana is not as great in the summer simply because they're using the same strict blend of gasoline that Chicagoland is. But Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, and especially into Missouri. Missouri has far lower prices than Illinois. So just about any one of our neighbors, whether you go north, east, south, or west, will have lower prices than Illinois does.
Have a good holiday weekend. Thanks for your time, Patrick.
And you as well. Take care.
Patrick DeHaan over at Gas Buddy. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, and Steve Bertrand has that.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. United Airlines CEO is now promising to work with the carrier's labor unions on what he's calling creative ways to cut labor spending and maybe avoid furloughs if travel demand doesn't recover by October. That's a contrast to his earlier dire tones on jobs and earlier attempts to move 15,000 workers to part-time status. Zing Health, a Chicago-based company offering Medicare Advantage HMO plans to underserved seniors in Cook County, just landed a big investment from New York-based New Light Partners. Chicago Inno says it could be worth about $150 million. And workers still aren't working, which means they still aren't riding Metra trains. Now the Tribune reports Metra is offering daily passes for only $10. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Back to you, Steve Bertrand.
Dow's down 99 points, the NASDAQ down 69, and the S&P 500 down 20.
And this is Orion Samuelson with an agribusiness update. Oh,
let me start with some good news before I look at the prices. This spring has brought a lot of uncertainty to many organizations in agriculture, and one of those organizations, FFA chapters and members across the country. But good news yesterday that Cargill, a 60-year partner of FFA, announced they will contribute $500,000 to the FFA to assist chapters across the country. Because normally in spring banquets, spring plant sales, and other fundraisers have been a good source of revenue for FFA chapters, but they have been canceled this year. And so thanks to Cargill and the other companies that are stepping up to do some help on that line. And then finally, among the other challenges we have, you can add one more, because U.S. forecasters said today they expect above normal 2020 Atlantic hurricane season. They expect, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they estimate 3 to 6 major hurricanes packing winds of at least 111 miles per hour may form this hurricane season. The last 2 years have seen an above-average number of named storms, 18 last year, 15 in 2018, and we could see even more, according to the meteorologists, because they're saying about half of this year's named storms may reach hurricane strength with winds of at least 74 miles per hour. Hurricane season starts June 1st. Ends November 30th, and the problem with many of those, as they move into the Gulf, they move north up the Mississippi just about at harvest time for crops in the Midwest, causing harvest delays because of the hurricane rains. That's your money on 720 WGN.
At 1248, this is WGN. Amy Guth joins us weekdays at this time. She'll be sitting in this chair at this time tomorrow. Hi, Amy.
Hey, John. How are you today?
Good. We'll be listening for you to do the Wintrust Business Lunch in my show. And here you've got more business news for us, as always. Where do we start today?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing I'm keeping an eye on is I've been very curious to see what those big retail brands' earnings reports were going to look like. Of course, earnings season is always really telling. There's always a story attached to the numbers. So especially some of the big box stores, we have most of those reports, a lot of their earnings calls have happened from their leadership to kind of tell the story of what happened and how it happened, and some really, really interesting spending habits. Things like Lowe's and Home Depot, we saw a huge growth in three areas. So in store, there was 6.4% increase at Home Depot, 11% in store for Lowe's. But online, it's really something else. 80% increase reported online at Lowe's. And of course, they were offering curbside, and hardware stores were considered essential here in the state. Home Depot, though, saw a 30% growth for their e-commerce in mid-March, but then triple-digit growth in April. A vice president said on their earnings call earlier that the last 3 weeks of the quarter were consistent with Black Friday levels, which is really, really stunning. Of course, so many retailers do so well during that time. But stores like Walmart and Target, things like that, also saw really significant earnings from e-commerce. Target was interesting because it was less about like groceries and staples. People were buying a little bit beyond the essentials at Target, because Target's kind of its own space and it's sort of an experience, not just run in and get your stuff. People kind of go and look at all the stuff and kind of aspirational shopping there too. Walmart is of note too because they spent $900 million doing this so far. Part of that was hiring about 200,000 new workers. Walmart really stood out as someone who worked very hard to keep stock up. They had a lot fewer outages than a lot of the other ones. They also, as many did, withdrew their financial outlook for the rest of the year. And the CEO on the call said, there's just too many variables right now with COVID. But all in all, we're seeing these big box stores that are reporting at minimum double-digit increases. Best Buy, to me, is one of the most surprising ones. They reported 154% increase in online sales. So when we're thinking about how they furloughed over 50,000 workers, they, you know, moved to curbside pickup only. We don't think about buying electronics during stay-home orders, but nonetheless, people did, likely in the entertainment realm.
A couple questions about some of those stores. You mentioned that Home Depot saw an increase not only online, but even in-store purchases at Home Depot.
That's right. 6.4% was the increase reported from Home Depot, which I was a little surprised about. I mean, I'm not really thinking of this time as like, let's renovate the bathroom. But nonetheless, I think maybe people were at home and kind of going, you know, I have not painted that wall and I have time to do it now. So we're not really sure what that increase was about, but that triple-digit growth and Black Friday numbers that they're reporting, that's pretty, pretty significant there.
Yeah, well, I do believe it is the DIY world that is driving some of that in-store purchasing at, say, a Home Depot, but I was just surprised that it would be equal to, let alone a little bit more than at normal times, just because of anxiety, financial pressure, or social distancing. I was at Best Buy and talked about that a little bit on my show this week, and I thought the experience in the store, I was able to go in the store, was extraordinary. And it was an escorted sales clerk that I made an appointment with online, then walked me through the store. And they greeted me and said, here's the protocol. Here's how you're going to shop. You're not going to touch anything. You're going to stay 6 feet from the guy. There was no pressure. It wasn't scary. It was just very reasonable. And they were doing business. And I was buying stuff because we needed stuff for, say, a home office or home education setup right now that we didn't need in the past. And
yeah, I think those of us in this field, we all had to run out and get that one cable or that one thing to make our, you know, be able to report from home. Yeah, that's really interesting, that experience at Best Buy. A lot of the big box stores and other areas of industry have been rolling out and making public some of their protocols for what it'll be like going forward, how they're going to maintain cleanliness, what they're going to do. And on these earnings calls, most of them also talked about what they've spent to keep things clean. Target, for example, said that they've spent about $500 million with cleaning, with social distancing, you know, measures and other kind of safety protocol, PPE and masks and stuff like that for workers in the store. I mean, $500 million is pretty significant, even though we're talking about 141% online sales increase for Target. So we're seeing big jumps, but also huge expenditures for most of them to keep up and make it safe and have that kind of experience you're talking about at Best Buy.
Is anybody talking about, will they sustain this? I'm thinking those stimulus checks and other compensation, the $600 unemployment benefits. I wonder if, particularly in the name of the stimulus checks, people are spending those at those stores. Will these numbers stay high? Is there any expectation or anticipation of that money going into the market? And I don't mean the stock market, obviously. I mean into the retail markets.
Yeah, you know, I think to me the tell is that so many companies have suspended or withdrawn their financial outlook for the rest of the year because there are just too many questions. You know, we don't know, does this go away in summer, or do we see another wave of this in the fall or the winter? Is it worse? Is it same? Is it better? There are so many questions. And I think particularly in areas like some other kind of retail, like clothes and stuff like that, furniture, household goods that are more decorative, more nice to have than need to have, we're really seeing so much uncertainty there. So I think a lot's going to depend on how this all plays out in terms of what that's going to be. But to me, that all these big companies have pulled back their, you know, their annual projections and said, hey, we're going to not stand by this forecast because we just don't know what it's going to be like. I think that's just kind of sitting with uncertainty, and that's really what all these leaders have to do right now.
You imagine retail points, a Nordstrom, a Macy's, a Target, probably had a whole lot, certainly they did have a whole line of spring clothes and summer clothes that people were going to be wearing this year and buying that now they are not. I don't know what happens to that inventory, but that's probably something they're not going to recapture. And maybe we'll be back spending because a lot of us do need to freshen up our wardrobes. And maybe that'll happen more at the end of summer. But one would hope that people are going to spend money that way.
Yeah, there was an interesting piece, I think it was in The Atlantic, but don't quote me on that, about what does this do to fashion and fashion buying habits? People are maybe dressing in a little more relaxed way. There's lots of jokes on social media about not wearing pants or just wearing yoga pants or sitting, you know, there was a reporter that wore a suit on top and shorts on the bottom and the camera could, you know, see that. So there is this kind of piece, talking to a fashion historian, what has happened with fashion after big events like this? And she was saying it usually goes one of two ways, that either people are craving high-end fanciness or they're kind of okay with casual and they want to be a little more casual and a little more practical. She was looking to World War I and World War II for examples of two very different things that happened after that. So we will see. I think a lot of that will have to do with the economy.
I've cut short, Amy. I got 45 seconds left, and I wanted to talk about Ford shutting down a plant. Can you just give us the headline on that?
Yeah, essentially Ford saw three shutdowns in 2 days. So to me, this is really kind of about here they're coming back from being closed down for almost 2 months. There is likely going to be a lot of bumps in the road as factories get back online and really, you know, you can write out the protocol, but really putting it into action, it's probably going to take some figuring out.
Yeah, it's about in the news today, and we'll talk more about it another day. Maybe you will tomorrow. It's nice to hear you. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.